As Russia's invasion of Ukraine rages, millions of refugees are seeking safety outside the country. European countries are welcoming them so far, but how many Ukrainians can they receive? And could this signal a new migration policy? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Hazem Seeker. The Russian invasion of Ukraine is in its third week with no sign of a let-up. The United Nations is warning the humanitarian crisis could grow and affect millions more. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says more than 2 million people have now fled the fighting. It's been described as Europe's worst refugee crisis since World War II. People are crossing to neighboring countries to the west, such as Romania, Slovakia, Hungary and Moldova. But most of Ukraine's refugees are in Poland. The government there has said to host them all, it will need more money than the EU is offering. Another 235,000 people have gone to other European countries. Well, the conflict in Ukraine is affecting large numbers of children as well. According to UNICEF, more than 1 million Ukrainian refugees are minors. Many are unaccompanied, either separated from their parents or sent away by those forced to stay behind. The UN has warned that unaccompanied children are at greater risk of suffering violence and abuse. It's urged host countries to ensure their safety. Well, let's bring in our guest now from the border town of Siemiec, Poland. Matthew Saltmarsh is the head of news and media for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. From Mexico City, we have Camille Lacoz, a senior policy analyst at Migration Policy, and joining us from Oxford in the UK, Alexander Betts, a professor of forced migration and international affairs at Oxford University. He's also an author of Wealth of Refugees, How Displaced People Can Build Economies. Good to have you all with us. So, Matthew Saltmarsh, let me start with you. How bad is the situation where you are right now? We're talking about a total of 2 million people who have fled in the space of 2 weeks. Just talk to us about the current conditions there for Ukrainians and the biggest challenges they're facing.
Well, as you said, the numbers are now quite comfortably over 2 million, and Poland in particular has been very generous, and there's about 1.4 million refugees who have come to this country, and significant numbers in those other countries around the region, but also importantly, increasing numbers who have moved on to Western Europe following this implementation or agreement, at least, of this temporary protection status. Here today in Siemiec, it's a little bit quieter than it has been in previous days. We're not entirely sure why that is, but one of the factors could be the fact that it's been very cold up the border, which is just 10 or so miles away from me. And so that may have dissuaded people from trying to cross. Obviously, it's hard to say exactly how the trends will go. That very much depends on the conflict and how that evolves within the country. But the immediate needs are obviously food, shelter, warmth, medical attention. The Poles here have been trying to take that away from the border area, and they're following a model whereby they will offer sort of full state security, state services, if you like, to those who decide to stay here. So they will get accommodation, they'll get medical support, and they'll get education. So that's just the kind of policy that we would advocate, and we warmly welcome what they've done so far.
And what is it that ordinary people can do to help Ukrainians beyond governments and government policy and financial assistance from the people that you've seen there and the biggest needs for them right now? There's been this great outpouring of sympathy throughout Europe over this. What can ordinary Europeans do?
Well, here in Poland in particular, the local NGOs, local humanitarians have come out en masse. They've gone up to the border to help with information, to help with transport. You see them at the train stations, providing water, providing support. and providing information that they'll need to decide where they're going to go next. In terms of the public at large in Europe, I think initially we would probably say the financial side is important. There are a number of appeals. More money will be needed. Those appeals will increase. So that's very important. And the public, as you said, have been incredibly generous so far. As refugees increasingly move perhaps to the West, to other countries, there are other things that people can do. There'll be volunteering, helping with education, translation, again, fundraising, just helping refugees to really find their feet and integrate in those societies, because unfortunately, this is not going to be very short term. It is going to be a bit longer, we think.
Indeed. Camille Lacaze, Matthew mentioned there at the beginning that this EU Temporary Protection Directive, which has been activated now. It wasn't activated back in 2015 during the refugee crisis there, when we saw people coming from escaping the war in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. Why is that? Why is it being activated now?
So I think first a bit of background on this Temporary Protection Directive, because it was adopted after the wars in the Balkans in the 90s. Was this idea that, yeah, the EU should have a mechanism in case of another large flows of refugees. And as Matt mentioned, you know, as a result of its activation last week, for people fleeing the war in Ukraine have now access to a range of rights, residency rights, right to work, right to education, housing, social welfare. And these are the same rights across all EU member states. And a key factor in this decision is that it avoids creating another massive backlog in the European asylum system. As several European officials have said in the past week, it's cut the red tape. And in a way, it's saved national asylum system from being completely overwhelmed. And as you mentioned, there have been discussion in the past to trigger this directive in 2011 after the Arab Spring, in 2015-16. But for us, observer of EU migration and asylum policy, it felt like it would never been activated. It's been a bit forgotten. And yet last week, EU member states came together, even the one like Poland and Hungary that have repeatedly opposed hosted refugee and solidarity across the EU. And they agreed that they needed this mechanism to respond to what looks like one of the largest displacement crises since World War II in Europe.
Alexander Betts, just more broadly speaking, what do you think are the political implications of all this influx of refugees that we've seen from Ukraine just in the last 2 weeks, and what it reveals about Europe, the response that we've seen from them?
I think we should celebrate the great solidarity we've seen across Europe towards Ukrainian refugees. It's been fantastic to see signs of commitment, empathy, solidarity, everyday humanitarian response across Poland, at railway stations. That's something that's been very important. I think, of course, behind that, this isn't the type of response we see to all refugees in Europe. It's not the type of response that we saw towards Syrian refugees or Afghan refugees. And equally, we see significant selectivity. So African refugees seeking to come across the Central Mediterranean often face drowning, detention, deportation. So I suppose the hope is that this moment of solidarity, public support for refugees, can be carried across to other refugee populations. I think one of the challenges is that while the humanitarian response in the short term has been very strong, the longer term challenge will be, can we make this a sustainable response? Can we provide the support that's needed to frontline countries like Poland, Hungary, Moldova, so that they can sustain hosting refugees for the medium to long term? Can they get access to financial support to buttress their public services, healthcare, education will be put under significant pressure, and housing, for instance? And can we create a viable relocation scheme that Europe has very rarely been able to agree upon to relocate some refugees from those countries across the 27 EU member states or beyond? So I think there's going to be questions about how we can make this sustainable, how we can plan for the medium to long term. But I think there's hope. There's hope that this could be a moment where the European Union gets its refugee and asylum policies right, can build in some of the opportunities for reform that were missed in the aftermath of the 2015-16 crisis.
Yeah, let's put some of that to Matthew then. I mean, this sustainability issue is a major one, isn't it? I mean, many of the Ukrainians that have arrived there, they may be getting basic shelter and housing and food for now, for the next couple of weeks, perhaps. But what about the next 2 months? What happens beyond then?
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest. No government in the region 3 weeks ago would have anticipated this huge scale of human movement across borders. Of course, people were aware of the tensions, but I don't think anyone was ready for this scale. And as I said earlier, the governments have really stepped up in each of those countries. They're leading that response. I think as things evolve and the weeks go on, they are looking beyond the immediate government. They're looking to the EU, of course, for funds. They're looking to the United Nations, and they're looking to other NGOs and international NGOs to come in with expertise, specialists who can support in areas like child support, education, and livelihoods, and then to obviously to try and raise more money, which will be extremely important. We've put out an appeal. Other parts of the United Nations have put out appeals, and obviously the needs financially and in terms of expertise are going to be absolutely enormous. They are already, but they're only going to grow.
Camille Lacoste, we mentioned at the top there, this is the worst refugee crisis that Europe has seen since the Second World War. What implications is this going to have for overall policy towards migration? Is this going to force a fundamental rethink?
I think it's really, really too early to say. And while Alexander mentioned Orb, I think there's really a specificity to this crisis that also explain why countries like Hungary and Poland have been more welcoming to refugees from, you know, to people fleeing Ukraine compared to previous crises. And, you know, we really see a difference in the response at the Polish border compared to what we've seen just a few months ago at the border with Belarus, with people, you know, refugee coming from Afghanistan and Syria or Iraq, and what the response was. And I think the specificity of this crisis is that this is a war in Europe. And so in a way, there is no other way for European government but to respond and to develop this, you know, to set up this mechanism. This is also a war that's a result of an aggression from Russia. And I think for countries like Poland, it kind of bring back some painful memories, and it reactivate somehow this need for European unity that we've seen in the past weeks. And then lastly, is this perception maybe that these refugees are different. And again, the support that we've seen from Poland that has so far seen 1.4 million of people fleeing from Ukraine is very different from the very, you know, drastic response that we'd seen at the Belarus border just 6 months before.
Alexander Best, talk a little bit more about the differences that you're seeing in how countries have responded to this. I mean, obviously, Poland has taken the brunt of this in the short term as far as the number of Ukrainians that they've taken in. But, I mean, what about the ones that are not sort of pulling their weight, so to speak?
Yeah, we need responsibility sharing across Europe. And this has been one of the challenges faced historically by the common European asylum system, that responsibility has been allocated through the so-called Dublin system to the frontline countries. So in the 2015-16 crisis, Greece was a frontline country. And other frontline countries like Hungary took a very restrictive view, building a razor wire fence, trying to prevent access to their territory. Now, what we've needed to do, and what the European Commission has recognised, is that we need to update that system to ensure that there's more consistent responsibility sharing, cooperation across the EU 27 member states. Now, this is a moment to put that to the test, to recognise that for this to be sustainable, the responsibility can't lie exclusively with Poland and the Visegrad countries, that we need to relocate both people and share money, that it will take significant resourcing to support public services, to build jobs and livelihoods opportunities. One of the positive things is we've got learnings that we can take from the aftermath of 2015-16. Germany in particular, which took the overwhelming majority of Syrian refugees arriving in Europe, provided huge investment to vocational training, employment integration, that took time to pay off, but over time has seen more and more Syrians enter labor markets in Germany and integrate socioeconomically. If we can learn from that and have a relocation scheme and financial support and viable opportunities to improve public services, employment opportunities, not only for Ukrainian refugees, but also local host communities in the areas most affected, we've got the best possible chance to have cooperation across Europe, but also ensure crucially that local receiving communities are still as responsive, enthusiastic, and committed to refugee rights in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, as they are today.
Yeah, Alexander brings up a big point, a good point there, Camille, about the Germany model in 2015, 2016. They took so many of the refugees from Syria. I think it was over a million of them, and they managed to integrate them into German society. So this can be done, can't it?
Yeah, and I think here it's really critical to avoid the perception that European government are losing control. And we know this has been a major shortcoming in 2015-16. And this could define whether, you know, all this popular support that we see now continue in the next months. And that, you know, I think here a key question, and that's also a lesson from 2015-16 and something that Germany has been a leader on, is how do we make sure that this right to work, this access to employment is effective? And so, again, a lot of tools have been deployed in terms of, you know, credential recognition that we're seeing reactivated now. And while we're all focused on the operational response, you know, the emergency and, you know, make this our instrument that has never been used before in Europe work, we need to be thinking about this medium to long-term consideration, because that's something maybe that in 2015-16 we didn't think about early enough.
Matthew Saltmarsh, I mean, as I mentioned there, so many people coming in such a short time. Are you getting a sense now at all that the various authorities are getting a handle on this, or do you expect it to continue to get worse?
It's very difficult to say right now. Obviously, that depends on events in Ukraine and the intensification there. But in terms of the government response, we think it has been exemplary. Of course, you know, there is going to be an element of chaos when you're dealing with this scale of movement. But if you look at the case of Poland, you've already got the offers of housing. We're starting to roll out very soon cash assistance for refugees here in Poland, and then that will go into other countries, working with some other partners as well. They're talking about vocational and medical training, recognition of qualifications for Ukrainians. And I think that's important because it helps the host country as well. There may have been something of a labor loss or a brain drain in Poland in particular in the last 5 or 10 years. So going back to that example of Germany, this could also be an opportunity for Poland to reskill and to get a lot of that talent that's come over from Ukraine. Unfortunately, if you look at it from the other side, it leaves the country of Ukraine in a very difficult position because so much of that talent and that workforce and young people will have come across. And of course, the male population at the moment, as you know, are engaged in combat.
Camille Lacaz, what implications is this going to have for asylum policy going forward?
Yeah, I think I think it's early. It's too early to say. And again, I think a key factor is going to be how perceived this response is. I think one thing I wanted to add also is, you know, we've talked about this, the activation of this mechanism, the Temporary Protection Directive. And what we're seeing on the ground is the need to register people very quickly with this mechanism that was never used before. And that has involved setting up specific registration system for people who are coming, and also relying on new mechanisms that have been set up since 2015 and 16, such as the EU Asylum Agency. That's now really helping out the countries that need to do this registration. So I think, in a way, we're seeing a lot of lesson learned on how to do better that we've done in the past. And hopefully this can have implication for, EU asylum and migration policy in Europe. But I really think we need to understand that this is a specific crisis compared to other situations that Europe has faced in the past decade.
Yeah, what's your view on that, Alexander Betts? This is something very specific, and the whole issue of whether there needs to be a broader policy change is something perhaps a bit more further into the future.
I mean, I think Europe has needed to change its policy response to asylum and immigration for a long time, and this might be the catalyst for that change. I think there is obviously something unique about this context of conflict on the borders of Europe. But we have seen moments in the past that parallel this, as we've already heard during the 1990s with the conflicts in Bosnia and Kosovo. We saw mass influx situations into Europe, and they were the moments that triggered significant innovation in European asylum systems. They created the Temporary Protection Directive in 2001, for instance, that is now being invoked, as we've heard, for the first time since its creation. So I think it's through moments like this that we recognize the need to update. That human displacement is going to be one of the defining challenges of the 21st century, that we live in an increasingly insecure world, and that we have to have national and regional and global systems that are adapted to that reality. So I think we shouldn't necessarily see this as just a one-off. It is possible that we will have other major drivers of displacement, including to Europe, and we need to ensure that we prepare for now, respond to the immediate crisis, but also have systems of responsibility sharing that can endure. I think it's also important to recognize that regions can learn from one another. So dealing with mass influx situations is something that regions beyond Europe have a lot of experience with. In Africa, for instance, there have been large-scale responses to movements of South Sudanese refugees, Somali refugees, that involved supporting public services, supporting livelihoods and employment creation for both refugees and host communities. And very recently in Latin America, the Venezuela situation is one we can learn from. Colombia has taken in similar numbers of refugees to those in Poland, and it very quickly provided them access to public services, a temporary status, the right to work. And so I think there's a lot of learning that can take place. And this is a moment where we can update our European refugee response, hopefully not only for this situation, but others in future.
Matthew Saltmarsh, what are some of the logistical challenges, perhaps, that your organization has been encountering? Communication down there, if that's been difficult at all. What are some of those challenges?
Well, obviously, inside Ukraine, there are huge logistical challenges. We've just started in recent days to move convoys of aid across the border into the western part of the country, and then trying to get that out into the more conflict-affected areas. The teams that we have there have been trying to get out when they can. It's not always, of course, been safe to do so. And they're trying to start with monitoring, so to locate where internally displaced people are, set up shelter structures, and then bring the basic support through to them. On this side of the border, I think the challenge in the first week was the sheer scale of arrivals. People obviously were passing through. Structures weren't put up in advance of that. And a number of people were just moving on without being traced or without perhaps the authorities knowing where they're going. So trying to bring in a little bit of order into that. You mentioned children and child protection. So trying to bring in more specialists and get in place those important steps that are needed in terms of identification and tracing and so on. So that's the focus really for now.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much to all three of you, Matthew Saltmarsh, Camille Lacoz, and Alexander Betts. Thanks very much for being on Inside Story. Thank you, as always, for watching. Remember, you can see this program again anytime. Just go to our website, aljazeera.com. And for more discussion, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is @AJInsideStory. For me, Hazem Sika, and the whole team here, bye for now.